We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that you really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojovics. Joining me today is Michael Snyder. He's the author of 6 books, a blogger, and publisher of the economiccollapseblog.com. How are you today, Michael?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. I originally heard about you through the Watchman Privacy podcast through Gabriel Custodiat, who's also been on our show. And I thought you had a really kind of interesting take on, you know, really everything that's going on right now. You really cover a lot of this stuff and you write pretty much a daily blog updating people about different perspectives on news stories and events going on around the world. So obviously most are concerned at the moment with the situation in the Ukraine. But I went back last week and listened to an old hardcore history podcast episode called The Destroyer of Worlds. And in it, Dan Carlin makes the interesting observation that he said, if you were born with a gun against your head, do you even notice it? So why do you think it is that most Americans and really Westerners don't see nuclear war with Russia as a serious threat?
Well, it saddens me because, well, basically people don't people assume that there'll never be a nuclear war with Russia because they've had this Cold War doctrine of mutually assured destruction pounded into our heads, right? So that we've always been told, and I grew up in the 1970s, 1980s, and at that time Cold War was, you know, really, really going. And we were always told, well, the Russians are probably never going to launch their missiles, because if they launch their missiles and we launch our missiles and we're both destroyed and life as we know it ceases to exist. And so that's pretty much why people, and it's come down to this day. In fact, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham just made some comments the other day, you know, basically reinforcing that kind of a mindset. So people don't understand that this is really is, things have changed. Things have changed over the last several decades. And now the Russians are openly threatening nuclear war. The day that Vladimir Putin launched the invasion, he threatened, you know, consequences like the world has never seen before. And obviously that was aimed at the United States and NATO, saying, if you intervene militarily, you know, we're threatening to potentially nuke you. And then a couple of days later, he put his nuclear forces on alert. And that once again was regarded as a threat to use nuclear weapons. Now, hopefully Putin was not serious in those instances, but we've got no point where we do need to think about these things. And in fact, earlier today, I was writing all about this, where over the past couple of decades, Russia has greatly upgraded and modernized their strategic nuclear arsenal. And the United States hasn't really. The foundation still of our land-based nuclear part of our the nuclear triad is the Minuteman III missiles, which first went into service in 1970. A few years ago, 60 Minutes actually did a feature where they were allowed into a silo. They were allowed access to inside, kind of an inside look at our strategic nuclear forces. And they found that the things like old rotary phones are still being used, things like the floppy disks, and not the small hard ones. I'm talking about like the big ones that you could hold in your hands and flop are still being used. You know, that's kind of the state of U.S. strategic nuclear forces. Now under Trump, a modernization program was begun. Hasn't gotten too far, but over in Russia, things are completely different. They've developed the Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile, the most advanced intercontinental ballistic missile in the entire world, can carry a 50 megaton payload. They brag they can wipe out, one missile can wipe out an area the size of France or the size of Texas, is what they've said. They've also developed hypersonic nuclear missiles that can travel up to 7,000 miles per hour. And we don't have anything that can defend against that either. But then they've also developed, they have now what we our people call black hole submarines, which are super, super quiet submarines, which can creep up to our coastlines. We never even know that they're there, surface, and then launch their nuclear missiles at us. And they would hit targets in the United States within just moments before we could even respond. And then they've developed what's known as the Poseidon. We call it the Poseidon in the Western world, which basically is not a, people say it's a torpedo, but it's actually a drone which can travel thousands of kilometers, then kind of park right off of a coastal city and wait to be detonated. And theoretically, the Russians could deploy numerous of these weapons off of our coastlines and detonate them all simultaneously, which would create a disaster and tsunamis and things that we can't even picture or imagine right now. So they've developed all these weapons. But once again, the Russians need a way, they're not going to do too much good if we can just fire back and wipe them out. But what the Russians have also developed over the past couple of decades is the most advanced anti-ballistic missile systems on the entire planet, far superior to anything we have. They've got the S-400, they've got the A-135, which is ringing Moscow as we speak. And those are very advanced systems capable of handling what we would throw at them. But now they've got the S-500, which is now coming into service. It actually was used in the Ukraine war, not to shoot down ballistic missiles, but at airborne targets, because it's it has multi uses. But the S-500 is more advanced than anything. It's a game changer. And is specifically designed, one of the things it's specifically designed for is to target intercontinental ballistic missiles. So the Russians have a very advanced defensive system, far, far, far more advanced than anything that we have. And what we have cannot handle the weapons that the Russians can throw out at us. So the bottom line is, the point I'm trying to make is that the whole calculus has changed. The whole scenario has changed, where it's not necessarily mutually assured destruction anymore. Certainly, I don't think the Russians want a nuclear war, but they've been preparing to fight one for the last several decades. Meanwhile, here in the United States, we've been preparing mostly to fight terrorists in the Middle East. And now these days, we've gotten very good at holding diversity seminars and implementing woke policies, and not necessarily to fight a future war with Russia or China. And now all of a sudden, war with Russia is on the front burner, potentially. And then things with China are getting a lot more tense, and we can talk about with that, because that's a huge concern of mine with the potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan. But the bottom line is, Russia is far more prepared to fight a nuclear war than we are. And that's a problem, because that gives the Russians a lot of power and a lot of leverage. Mm-hmm.
Michael, as we think about, you know, how much has been spent on defense by the US government over the past, you know, let's say 30 years, why do you think that none of these systems were upgraded or developed to at least defend against something like this?
Yeah, I think our priorities were really messed up, because, you know, the Cold War ended and we declared ourselves the victors of the Cold War, and it, you know, for a long time it appeared we were completely victorious, and NATO expanded eastward, and so we thought, well, that threat's over. The Cold War is over. We don't have to prepare for the Cold War or potential war with Russia anymore. It's a new world. And so then we get to 9/11, you know, a couple decades ago, and all of a sudden terror in the Middle East. And we start spending massive amounts of money, you know, on Afghanistan and Iraq, talk about money pits. And that was our thing. We thought, okay, now we're going to be the police of the world. We're going to fight in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. We're going to fight Islamic terrorists. We're going to fight terror groups around the world. That's going to be kind of the new primary mission of the U.S. military. So much time and money and energy and resources went into focusing on that. And then, you know, and then, of course, these days, within the past 5 to 10 years, so much of the focus has gone into, okay, now we want a woke military. Now we want a diverse military, and so much time, effort, and energy is going into that and implementing a social agenda in the military. Meanwhile, I wrote not too long ago, a recent survey that, you know, they asked members of the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army, you know, are your units prepared to fight right now? And the results were depressingly low. In fact, only about 70% of our planes can even fly right now, you know, so like 30% of our planes can't even fly right now. According to the survey, the vast majority of Army units are not ready to deploy right now. They would need at least some time to get ready. So, and I don't know what else they're doing, because if you're in the military, you have one job, and that's to be ready to fight a war if something happens, you know. So I don't know why they're not ready, but yeah, our military, you know, my father was in the Navy. I was very proud to be the son of a naval officer growing up. I was very proud of our military. I grew up in the era of Reagan, and I embraced that. So I was once very proud of our military, proud to be associated with it through my father. But these days, I'm horrified at what I see from our military. And then you look at our performance. We went into Afghanistan, fought for 20 years against a bunch of drug dealers and goat herders and terrorists known as the Taliban. But these guys were not sophisticated. They were not a modern military. And you think that supposedly the greatest military machine in the history of the world, the U.S. military, we can crush them. So we spent 20 years, two decades fighting these guys, pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into Afghanistan, some say more, and with the latest military technology. So we get to the end of 20 years fighting the Taliban. And then we say, okay, we're going to pull out. And before we can even pull out, the Taliban conquers the entire country and basically kicks us in the rear end on our way out the door. You know, that's the state of our military today. Not very impressive, if you ask me.
Hmm. So you kind of mentioned this earlier, but how do you see the actions thus far in the conflict by the U.S. administration as pushing Russia and China closer together? And what would that mean for the West?
Yeah, talk about extremely, extremely alarming, because the United States has been very aggressive with both Russia and China going back a number of years, but particularly since Biden took over. So Russia and China have been getting closer, because ultimately the Chinese, you know, and in the old days, people never understood this, because they thought China is our friend. We trade with China, you know, but the Chinese, their perspective is that ultimately there's a showdown coming with the United States someday. And with the Western world as a whole, but particularly the United States is kind of the leader of the Western world, if you will. And so we're going to have a showdown with the United States. So we need friends. And so China is kind of a marriage of convenience, although in the old days, in the Cold War, China and Russia and the old USSR were very close. But China has gravitated toward Russia, and Russia's gravitated toward China. And so we have this situation with Ukraine, and Russia has gone into Ukraine, but China hasn't condemned it. China has not condemned it. And there's a reason for that, you know, and ultimately people need to understand that because China wants Russia's support when China goes into Taiwan, but also China is carefully evaluating and watching, okay, how is the Western world responding to Russia? Because it'll give us some clues of how they're going to respond to us when we take Taiwan, because Taiwan, the Chinese consider that sacred Chinese territory. They believe it's always belonged to China. It belongs to us. Reunification is just a matter of time. It's probably going to have to be an invasion because the government of Taiwan isn't cooperating. But China's always been held back by the United States. But now they see an opening because of ultimately the weakness of the Biden administration. They saw what happened in Afghanistan. I think that emboldened the Russians and it certainly emboldened the Chinese. And now they're seeing that there's no military intervention by NATO in Ukraine. So that China's thinking, well, maybe we can go into Taiwan and no one's going to intervene and we can do this now. We might have to endure some sanctions or whatever. But if we've got we're friends with Russia, well, number one, we can get energy from Russia, we can get food from Russia, and we can talk about this later on, how important Russia and Ukraine are for the global food system, the emerging global food crisis, because this is a huge story going to affect all of us. Mm-hmm. But China is like, okay, we can import food and energy from Russia, and then Russia needs a lot of things that China produces, so it, you know, there's a lot of synergy there between them, but then ultimately, Both of them see the United States as the ultimate enemy. The Russians certainly do as well. And so, you know, to have that alliance together to confront the what they consider to be the growing hegemony of the United States, the increasing aggressiveness of the United States, they find some comfort in that. And that has helped them to tighten relations moving forward. Because they essentially need one another. They don't want to be totally isolated, and so this helps that insulate them from that. And they're not totally isolated. India is being. In fact, just today I saw India said, "Hey, Russia's going to give us oil at a discount. We'll take that." And of course, that upsets the Biden administration. But you know, the Biden administration is kind of operating under a paradigm where they think, "Hey, we're still the police of the world. We're still the big bad boss. We get to tell everybody what to do, and everybody better fall in line, or we're going to threaten them." And in fact, the U.S. has just threatened China with sanctions, basically saying, "Hey, if you help Russia get around our sanctions, we're going to sanction you." And the Chinese were not. We're not pleased with that at all, and they responded back quite bluntly to that. But every time the Biden administration gets more aggressive with these threats, well, that's just driving Russia and China more closely together, and we should not want that. But people need to understand that Joe Biden is literally surrounded, and I'm not exaggerating. I said this back at the beginning of his administration. People thought Michael's exaggerating. He's just saying this. He would say this about any administration. Yeah. No, I wouldn't. But Joe Biden has literally surrounded himself with an all-star team of warmongers that's corrupt, and that's also incompetent. So you combine all that together, that's a very bad recipe, a very bad combination. But the team he has around him is disastrous, and they've been provoking Russia, they've been provoking China, they've been provoking lots of people, thinking they're the big, bad, tough guys. They get to tell everyone what to do. But then you make a mistake and something like Ukraine happens, where they just pushed too hard, too far. They overreached and they were too aggressive and they provoked the right. And, they made mistake after mistake after mistake. And I was saying, don't do that because I want peace. I don't want this war. No, but in fact, most Americans, most Russians don't want this war. Most people in the world don't want this war. Now, most of us have this war that we do not have. And if we're not careful, it's going to escalate into World War III, Tom. Mm-hmm.
So what are some of those, you bring up World War III, right? And at this point, we're only seeing Russia in Ukraine. But what are some of the 10 signs that China is drawing closer to launching an invasion into Taiwan, as you mentioned?
Yeah. And this is something that I just wrote about yesterday about that, where now that Russia has gone into Ukraine, like I said, the Chinese are they're evaluating, they're looking, because this is an opportunity, because we've got this guy in the White House. He's not all mentally there. That should be obvious to everyone across the political spectrum. And the Chinese see he's weak. He's weak in Afghanistan. He's being weak with Russia. And so the Chinese probably consider this a window of opportunity until probably 2024, because then everyone can pretty much see Biden's days are probably going to be over at that point in terms of being in the White House. So probably until the election of 2024, there's probably this window of opportunity here. And also the fact that Russia is in Ukraine, well, the whole world is focused on that right now, right? They're all looking at that, and NATO, they're all geared up. They're all mobilized there to potentially confront Russia if it's needed. And so this is a great opportunity for China, because if China had just done it in normal times when no other war was going on, invaded Taiwan, well, the whole world would be getting in an uproar and everyone would be like, "Oh, we hate China. We got to get China. Our focus is on China." But if everyone's distracted by Russia and Ukraine and then China goes in, well, people still be upset with China in the Western world. But then there's going to be attention will be divided. Forces will be divided. Attention, so that makes this also a real good window of opportunity for China. And then the thing is, Tom, before the thing in Ukraine started, I was pushing a diplomatic solution. I was like, please, Biden administration, find a diplomatic solution. Let's find a way out of this mess. And Russia was saying, this is what we need. And but the Biden administration said, no, we're not going to compromise one bit. And anyway, my point is that a diplomatic solution that would have kept the Russians out of Ukraine was possible. Mm-hmm. But they completely fumbled the ball. With China, there's not going to be a diplomatic solution. The Chinese are absolutely obsessed with Taiwan, and they believe it belongs to them, and no amount of diplomacy will ever make the Chinese government agree, hey, you leave Taiwan alone, Taiwan can do what they want, you mitts off China. And China's never, ever, ever going to agree to that. And so, so this is the situation. We need to try to de-escalate, but instead, Jake Sullivan, this guy, national security advisor, I wouldn't trust the guy to be the assistant manager of a Dairy Queen, Tom, honestly. I mean, the guy, he's horrible. He's a warmonger. He's been a warmonger for a really long time. He should have the thought that he could even have any sort of a government job should be unthinkable, much less being national security advisor to the president of the United States. He's horrible. But so he's running around this week.
That sounds almost as bad as having a drama teacher for a prime minister.
Exactly. Isn't it crazy? I mean, these people, I don't know how they get into positions of power, but I think it's indicative of how far Western society has fallen. So it's really sad. It's really sad. You look at the leaders around the Western world, whether it's Macron or Trudeau or so many of these jokers. But anyway, but Jake Sullivan's running around saying, hey, we're going to punish China if it helps Russia get around the sanctions. They're saying, and now they're saying, we're accusing Russia of asking China for military equipment for the war in Ukraine. The Chinese heard about that. And they said, no, I've never heard of that. And then the Chinese have also come out and they blamed the US and NATO for pushing relations with Russia and Ukraine to a breaking point, which they did. I mean, China's telling the truth there, but most Americans don't understand this because all they hear is from the mainstream media. And all they hear is about, they don't hear about all the backstory and everything that happened in Ukraine going all the way back to 2014, which brought us to today, the crisis we're at today. All they hear about is, oh, Putin is bad and he's evil and he wants to conquer the world. So he went into Ukraine. It drives me nuts because there's so much more nuance than that. There's so much more history that goes all the way back to 2014 and even back before that. But, really with the revolution there, which that's a whole another deal, which the U.S. was very much involved in. But anyway, the officials in Taiwan are very aware of what's going on with the potential for a Chinese invasion. In fact, today I saw more Chinese jets just today. Since I wrote the article that I wrote, more jets have gone into the Taiwanese air defense zone. And it's been kind of a regular thing in recent months where Chinese they're sending the jets into the air defense zone. And it's sending a message to Taiwan, and it's a threat. And it's a threat of military action. It's a threat. And it's a message. It's meant to send a message to the United States as well. And Taiwanese authorities are even saying that, hey, China's started cyber warfare against us, which we saw, before Russia went into Ukraine, we saw cyber attacks and so forth. And so all these things, are signs, and we need to take them seriously. China continues to be very aggressive with Taiwan and continues to, and just the other day, China said, if anyone intervenes militarily and helps Taiwan militarily, they're going to have severe consequences. So for the Chinese to make a statement like that, it's a serious thing. The Chinese don't make threats like that lightly. So, that's kind of where we're at, Tom, and it's very alarming. Mm-hmm.
So, I'd like to switch gears here a little bit, Michael, and ask you about, you, of course, one of the blogs that you write is entitled The Economic Collapse Blog. So in that vein, you wrote a recent piece entitled Catastrophic Inflation. I've never seen prices jump this high this fast. So why is the headline inflation that we're now seeing not very comparable to, let's say, the 70s or the 80s?
Yeah. Well, we just, a while back here, we got the latest number for February for inflation, right? And they said 7.9%, consumer prices were 7.9% higher in February than a year ago. And they were telling us that's the highest figure in 40 years. And so that sounds bad, right? Mm-hmm. Because worse than 40 years, that certainly sounds bad. But what people need to understand is the way that inflation is calculated by the government has been altered, has been changed more than two dozen times since 1980. And every single time they changed the formula, the goal was to make it look lower, you know, because that makes government officials look good. It makes presidents look good. It affects Social Security increases and a whole bunch of things. But the goal was to always let's make the rate of inflation look lower and lower and lower. And so when we're comparing today to 40 years ago, it's not an apples to oranges comparison. It's not a fair comparison. And so what you need to do is you need to take the numbers and you need to calculate it and come up with what would the inflation rate look like today if it was still calculated the way it was back 40 years ago. And so John Williams of shadowstats.com actually does a great job of this. He's been doing it for years, and he calculates what the rate of inflation would look like if it was still calculated the way it was in 1980. And according to him, if it was still calculated the way it was back then, it would be over 15%. Right now. And so we're talking about a level of inflation that is very similar to what we experienced during the Jimmy Carter era of the 1970s. Now, most of February was before the Russian invasion, right? You know, because we had already had all this inflation. Why did we have all this inflation? You know, right now, Biden is trying to convince all of us it's Putin's fault. It's Putin's fault. Prices are going up so much. This is all Russia's fault. Well, not exactly, because what happened since the start of 2020, our Congress critters have borrowed and spent trillions and trillions of dollars that we did not have, borrowed and spent. Trillions and trillions of dollars that we did not have in an attempt to stimulate the economy because of the COVID pandemic. They said, we got to spend all this money. You know, our economy's in trouble. We got to do something. So they pumped trillions of dollars into the system. Then the Federal Reserve separately, they said, we got to prop up the financial system. So they kind of went quantitative easing on steroids over the last couple of years, where they pumped trillions upon trillions of fresh dollars created out of thin air into the financial system to prop up the financial system by buying bonds and so forth. But then the stock market loves when they do that. So stock prices have been inflated to this ridiculous bubble. And so they were able to prop up the financial system. But what had happened is they flooded the system with all this money, and our Congress critters flooded the system with all this money. And so this has created the biggest inflation crisis that we've seen since the days of Jimmy Carter. But that was before the war, right? Now we've got to the point where war has erupted. And this is going to take our inflation problem to an entirely new level. Because with this war, it's going to cause supply problems, particularly when we're talking about energy and food, which we all use all over the world. Everybody uses all over the world. All of a sudden, supply crunch with energy, supply crunch with food. And that's going to cause our inflation problems to kind of go to the next level, to go to kind of accelerate. And so that's a problem. You know, you look at the price of gasoline. When I wrote my article, the average price of a gallon of gasoline had increased to 13% just over the previous week. And then since the same time last year, it was up 38%. So people are going to the gas station in some areas of the country now. Some areas of the country, like Los Angeles, people have been paying $6 or even $7 a gallon for gasoline. And I believe it won't eventually. We're going to be seeing those sorts of prices all over the country. $6 or $7 a gallon, which is going to have very serious consequences, not only for our pocketbooks, not only pain when we go to fill up our vehicles, but it's going to affect the price of everything, because ultimately, you know, everything we buy at the store has to be transported to the store, and that takes energy. Or if we call up somebody, hey, come and fix something at my home, while people have to drive there, that's energy, you know. So ultimately, or just heating our home in the winter, that's energy. So energy prices are going up all over the world. Oil, natural gas prices in Europe, because this whole thing with Russia have gone to insane heights we've never seen before. We're having coal, propane. I just got a propane bill the other day, Tom. $822 to fill up my propane tank. Can you believe that?
What would that compare to, let's say, for a year ago? What did it cost?
A year ago, it had been like half that, maybe $400 or $500, something like that. I mean, it's just crazy. But this is the new reality that we live in. In fact, before this winter, one source was warning of a propane Armageddon because sources of propane were getting very tight. So this is very alarming. And this is just the beginning of a supply crunch, because it's not just the war in Ukraine, which doesn't look like it's going to be wrapping up anytime soon, but all over the world we're having a supply crunch, particularly in the Western world, where, you know, there's governments have been wanting to discourage traditional forms of energy, and then you've got the elite financial institutions. They don't want to finance exploration. They don't want to finance new projects of traditional forms of energy because they're like, we don't want to contribute to global warming. And so there's this been hesitancy to move forward with increasing supplies of traditional forms of energy. Meanwhile, these alternative forms of energy are not ready for prime time. They're not ready to produce all the energy we need. So supplies have gotten tighter and tighter and tighter. And that's a problem. And then Europe has become so dependent on natural gas from Russia. In fact, in the United States and UK have said, the US has said no to natural gas. UK has said no to oil from Russia. But the rest of Europe is saying, no, we need our Russian energy supplies. Even though we're going to object really strongly and impose other sanctions, we need our natural gas from Russia, because literally Europe could not function without that natural gas from Russia. Mm-hmm.
I know I was talking to somebody the other day, and they kind of alluded to a tweet that they had seen that said, if Russia cuts off Europe's supply of natural gas, they're going to meet their zero carbon emissions targets much earlier than expected.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a pretty catastrophic thought when we think about what the consequences of that would be, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And especially in the middle of winter in Europe, I mean, it gets really cold in some of those places. So, you know, fortunately, we're getting toward the end of winter here. But I feel really bad for the people of Ukraine stuck in the middle of this, and in some of those cities where they've been cut off from supplies of food and supplies of energy. And now they're going to get really cold and really hungry over there. So and speaking of food, I mean, you've got Russia and Ukraine collectively normally account for somewhere around, I've seen a couple different figures, but somewhere around 30% of all wheat exports in a normal year come from Russia and come from Ukraine. And so this is a major problem, because food supplies have already been getting very tight around the planet. Before the war, we are already seeing an increase during the COVID pandemic of the number of people living in hunger. And then we were seeing before the war, even we were seeing the price of fertilizer, and this ties in with energy, but the price of fertilizer was going through the roof. And I wrote about this a few months ago, where one farming insider told me, he said, Michael, the prices of some fertilizer has doubled, some have tripled, some have quadrupled. And so I wrote about this. I said, hey, this could be really bad, guys. And it has really bad, and my farming insider, a friend, told me that, hey, it's not going to be profitable for us to plant corn this year. And that's going to be the case for lots of farmers all over the country here in the United States. And that's turned out to be the case, because, you know, corn uses a lot of fertilizer. Mm-hmm. And so that's a major, major problem in terms of corn production this year. But then in other parts of the world, Africa, where a lot of farmers, because now the price of fertilizer, they're not going to be able to use fertilizer at all. Or they're going to have to cut back dramatically. But in any event, it was being projected before the war. And Russia is also a very big player in the fertilizer industry. It was being projected before the war that the amount of food that would be pulled out of production that would not be produced in Africa this year because of the cost of fertilizer would be roughly the equivalent of the amount needed to feed 100 million people And we're talking Africa alone. So Africa was saying, well, we're going to have to import massive amounts of food from somewhere else because we're not going to be able to grow enough to feed our people. Mm-hmm. But of course, now everyone's looking to import food. And now Russia and Ukraine is not able to export food. And they banned it anyway because they said we need it for ourselves. And then everyone wants to say, OK, we don't want Russian exports. And Russia is actually, you know, put some restrictions on certain exports as well. But basically what this is going to create is just a massive problem with food. For example, you look at Lebanon, which normally you've got 80% of their people are dependent on food from the government. And the government imports the vast majority of the wheat it uses from either Russia or Ukraine. Now, Lebanon doesn't know what they're going to do because they can't feed their people. Same thing with Egypt, where they import the vast majority of the wheat they use from the region. And so it's going to have ripple effects throughout the Middle East, throughout Africa, throughout the entire globe. Because of the lack of exports now. So, I mean, we really are heading for a global food crisis, and the price of fertilizer is not going to come down anytime soon. Ultimately, food prices are going to continue to rise pretty dramatically in the months ahead. And who's it going to hurt? Well, you and I can go to the store and we're like, oh man, you know, now my cart of food is $300. That's painful, but most of us are still going to pay it. But who it's going to hurt the most are the people at the bottom of the economic food chain around the world, who are the poor and who are just barely scraping by as it was. This is going to hurt them so much. And a lot of people are saying, well, the conditions that we saw in the Arab Spring 2011, we're starting to see that again. People are going to get angry. There's going to be food riots. But back then it was temporary and we knew it was mm-hmm. going to be temporary. Now we're moving into a long-term situation where people could be really hungry and really angry for an extended period of time.
So right as you're saying, Michael, there, at what point do people's grocery bills start to affect their behavior and lead to civil unrest?
Well, here in the United States, I think we will eventually get to that point. I saw one analysis the other day where they said Americans this year are going to have to spend $2,000 more on energy and $1,000 more on food than they normally would. So, I mean, that's $3,000 out of our pocket. And so that's a problem. And we've already, over the past couple of years, we've had some persistent shortages. You go to the store and you notice, hey, something's missing. You look at you go over to the dog food aisle and you're like, where's the canned cat food? Where's the canned dog food? There's been a pretty severe shortage of baby formula, you know, but it hasn't gotten to the point where anyone's starving. No one's starving in the United States today. No one's good. You know, most people, you know, there you got the homeless on the streets. People are hungry. But in general, the population is still well fed. But people are starting to get restless. People are starting to list inflation as their top concern. People, in fact, I saw a survey earlier today, over 80% of Americans say that inflation is causing them stress. So, you know, people are not happy. People are blaming Biden. His approval ratings have gone into the tank. There's a lot of restlessness that we're seeing. Now, eventually, I think that all this, the anger and the frustration, will bubble over into civil unrest, more civil unrest. And we've seen horrifying civil unrest in recent years with the George Floyd and the BLM and different things that happened then in 2020. I believe that's just a preview of what's coming. And then in more recent times, we've seen just these giant hordes of shoplifters going in and organized teams just going in and grabbing stuff and going out of stores and shoplifting has become worse in the United States than ever before, particularly places like New York and San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, and so on. Our country, we're not in a good state. And when things really go south economically and supplies of food and certain things start getting really, really tight, our society is not going to handle it well. And I believe we will see civil unrest, not just for a little while, but we're going to see extended long-term civil unrest for a period of time, and it won't be pretty. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of grocery bills, something that surprised me as I was reading through your blog was the advent of bird flu again in the U.S. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the price of meat has already been going up, particularly in the price of food, you know, across the board has been going up. But you look at the price of meat in particular has been becoming very painful. And so just the other day, there was an article on Yahoo News where they said they referred to beef as a luxury meat. Now, I never heard that before in my entire life. You know, probably you haven't either. Luxury meat? Are you kidding me? You know, I'm 52 years old. I never heard of that before. But in Florida, at least, Walmart has been locking up some of the steaks in these metal cages where you have to take to the counter and have them unlock it before you go out of the store, because people have been stealing the steaks, you know, and we've seen that in other places as well, where literally steaks have become a key target for shoplifters. So the price of beef has gotten kind of crazy. So people say, well, I'll just switch to chicken and turkeys. Well, that's going to become a lot more expensive too, because starting in February, a bird flu pandemic has erupted in the United States, is now in 13 different states, the last that I saw. It may be more by now. But it's from the East Coast all the way to the middle part of the country. Nebraska, Iowa, South Dakota have been affected now. So it's already spread over a very wide geographic area. And as a result of this bird flu pandemic, which is spreading like wildfire, they don't have it under control. So far, in just the first month, 2.8 million birds were killed. The vast, vast majority of them, almost all of them, were chickens and turkeys. It keeps popping up on the poultry farms, on the facilities that are raising turkeys. So now you know, price of chicken and turkey were already going up. Now you pull out nearly 3 million chickens and turkeys in just the first month. Okay. So this thing is likely to get even worse. It's going to be around for a while regardless. So how many more millions of chickens and turkeys are going to be killed, put down, taken out of production in the middle of an emerging global food crisis at a time when the price of meat has already been soaring? What is that going to mean for the price of chicken and turkey? And then beef is going to continue to rise as well. This is a problem. And this is kind of the last thing we needed, you know, on top of everything else. But it's kind of like this perfect storm, you know, just when we think, oh, man, it's as bad as it can get. Well, something else happens. Something else erupts. But, you know, I've been warning for a long time that we are moving into this kind of perfect storm environment. And now we are here.
And you know, Michael, as you really mentioned that perfect storm environment, can we kind of think of the beginning of it as the amount of U.S. debt piling up?
Well, that's something I've been warning about for a long time. When, you know, I remember, you know, Ronald Reagan first ran for president, he said, U.S. debt, we're at this $1 trillion mark. Oh, this is so horrible. And it was horrible. But now we've gone from 1 trillion to 30 trillion, you know, we're you know, basically at that threshold, staring that down now. And I mean, it's unimaginable. Personally, I never thought we would get to 30 trillion. So I guess it's a testament to the bankers and everyone in those in positions of power. They propped things up and we actually got to 30 trillion, you know, so I guess kudos to them. But really, you know, we've been living. It's the biggest debt bubble in the history of the world, and it just keeps accelerating over the past couple of years, accelerated like we've never seen before. And we just keep pumping trillions more in, destroying our currency, destroying the reserve currency of the world. And the fact that we have the reserve currency of the world makes our standard of living possible, because the rest of the world needs U.S. dollars. And so that we send them our U.S. dollars for their goods and services and at a much cheaper rate than we would get otherwise if we didn't have the reserve currency of the world. And so that makes our standard of living possible, the standard of living that we all enjoy. So if that goes away, our standard of living just completely changes. And you know, people need to understand that. But so we're destroying the reserve currency of the world. We're destroying our future. We're piling all this debt on future generations, if there are future generations of Americans. But what we're doing to future generations of Americans, as I've described for a long time, is beyond criminal. You know, and our politicians in Washington should not just be ashamed of themselves, but they should be in prison for what they are doing and have done to future generations of Americans. And it was a big issue for me when I ran for Congress in 2018. I wanted to do something about it. But, you know, of course, it just keeps going, and the party's going to keep going and keep going. And no one seems inclined to stop it until it just completely blows up and collapses. But we're kind of at that terminal phase now where inflation's out of control and our currency's being destroyed and everything else. Now people can see it starting to happen. People are like, what are we going to do? Well, it's too late now. You know, good luck. You know, we're in big trouble.
So, Michael, is it a possibility that the U.S., as you mentioned, that has basically exported dollars to the rest of the world for the last several decades, when the world doesn't see the need for those dollars anymore, will inflation come home to roost much, much worse than it currently is?
Oh, yeah, in a major way, because most people don't realize that far more dollars are used outside of the country than inside the country, you know? And so when that equation changes and the rest of the world says, hey, maybe we'll trade in some other countries, you know, Russia and China are saying, well, maybe we don't need the U.S. dollar. And this is one of the reasons why it's so dangerous to drive Russia and China together, because then they say, OK, well, we're just going to reject the U.S. dollar and we're going to start trading with one another. You know, and then I saw where India and Russia are talking about using their own national currencies to trade with one another and cutting the U.S. dollar out. And so, I mean, you talk about India and China and Russia, that's a pretty big chunk of the global population right there, you know? And so, they, you know, the U.S. is being very aggressive and pushing everyone around. But if you have, you know, if people start abandoning the U.S. dollar, that is really bad news to us, because then all those dollars start coming flooding back, and then that's a major problem.
Mm-hmm. So since we have seen the start of the pandemic as a major breakdown in supply chains, the problem has certainly been amplified in the production of semiconductors or computer chips and vehicle manufacturing, obviously, especially so. So do you see these supply chains starting to recover, or things continuing to deteriorate there?
Well, I think things would have had a chance to recover, particularly with the computer chips, if this war in Ukraine had not started, because people need to understand this war in Ukraine is also going to affect the chip industry. Because people need to realize that Russia supplies over 40% of the global supply of palladium, and Ukraine produces 70% of the global supply of neon. And these are important things, because palladium and neon are two resources that are key to the production of semiconductor chips. So if you pull out 40% of the world's production of palladium and 70% of the global supply of neon, that's a huge problem, because that's going to make our chip shortage a whole lot worse. And, you know, today, just about every industry that you could possibly think of relies on equipment that uses chips. You know, we're using chips right now, but, you know, for example, the auto industry, you know, they need chips to go into their vehicles. In fact, over the past 2 years, there have been times when a lack of chips has forced some of the biggest automakers in the entire globe to close down facilities for a certain period of time, because they simply did not have the chips they need to go into the vehicles to finish the vehicles. And so now with this war in Ukraine, because of the factors I just mentioned, there's the potential that this chip shortage is going to get a whole lot worse. And then that affects thousands of other industries. That has ripple effects throughout countless supply chains. And so our supply chain, because we're so globalized today and we rely on, you know, ultimately the vast majority of our computer chips are over 50% of our computer chips ultimately come from Taiwan, the finished product. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the biggest global player in computer chips. So what happens if China invades Taiwan? boy, we're in a real big pickle there, you know. And then, you know, China, our stores are filled with stuff from China. People don't even realize that, like, most of our apple juice, we send the apples over and then it comes back to us as juice. You know, we become so globalized, so dependent on places like China and Taiwan and otherwise. We never should have done that, but we did. I've been preaching about this for years. And now, boy, if global war starts spreading and China invades Taiwan and goes on from there, boy, global supply chains are going to break down. If people think the shortages have been bad so far, after we get to things are going to get worse now because this war in Ukraine, and people need to realize that. But if China invades Taiwan and all of a sudden we can't get our chips from Taiwan, we can't get anything from China because we're in a state of war with China, the shortages are going to be catastrophic in the United States and the Western world. It's going to be worse than most people would dare to imagine.
So, Michael, you know, when we think about all of the problems we've talked about, it seems almost endless here. You've written several books on kind of things to consider to prepare for some of this stuff. So what are some of the ways that you prepare for what you see coming?
Yeah, well, I believe we live at a time when everything's breaking down. It's not just the economy. We're already in the early chapters of economic collapse, but basically with societal collapse, we've talked about that today. And basically, all the systems that we rely on are crumbling, collapsing in so many different ways. And so I encourage people, whatever they can do to become more independent of the system, I think is a good thing, whether it's as something as simple as learning to grow your own food, having your own business, finding unique ways to make money, developing strong bonds in your own community where you can all rely on one another for different things. You know, learning basic health care and first aid. So if something happens, well, is the hospital going to be able to take care of you? There have been times when hospitals have been so overwhelmed over the past couple of years in the pandemic where hospitals have had to turn people away for different things. You know, so learning how to take care of some basic things on your own, you know, any skills you can acquire, any ways that you can prepare yourself so you're not dependent on the system or somebody else to do it for you. Because like I said, the system is failing. It's one of the big reasons I wrote a book a number of years ago entitled Get Prepared Now. But it is encouraging people to become more self-sufficient and prepare for a time, the times we're in and moving into, when things are crumbling all around you. How are you going to make it? What are you going to do? How are you going to survive? You know, as supply chains collapse, people not only need to, people think, well, I'm going to get some buckets of emergency food, but really I encourage people to store up anything that they might need for an extended period of time. We saw early in the pandemic, you know, right as COVID came along, what people raced out and were hoarding toilet paper. All of a sudden, there was no toilet paper on the shelves. Now, that only lasted for a certain amount of time. But what if a long-term national emergency comes, war comes, all the things I talk about in my books come, and you not only need things for a few weeks, but you're looking at a long-term situation for months or even years where you need to rely on what you've got already at home. Well, most Americans couldn't do that. Most Americans only have a very limited amount of food and supplies in their home, and then they have to go back into the stores. And that's been okay all these years because we could always go out to the stores and get more. But a time will eventually come when we can't do that, and people need to prepare for those days.
Do you see a role for precious metals to play in the preparations for what you see coming? Or, you know, what considerations do you put towards finances in certain circumstances like that?
Well, I do recommend gold and silver. I like gold and silver. I like precious metals. I think their values are going to be going way up as we get deeper into crisis mode, if you will. However, having said that, I recommend first, before you ever get gold and silver, have a very large emergency fund. So if something happens, you lose your job or you get hit with a sickness like COVID or whatever disaster comes along, that you can continue to pay your mortgage. If you have a mortgage, you can continue to pay your bills. You can continue to pay to heat your home, what, you know, the things you need to do. So I'm a very big advocate of having a large emergency fund for potential emergencies. But then, and having said that, I think that having emergency food and supplies are more important than gold and silver, because you can't eat gold and silver. So if you're in a truly, because eventually we're going to be in a real meltdown scenario, in which you're going to want to have food to eat. And if so, if you have a bunch of gold and silver, well, maybe you can go out and trade that for some food or whatever you might need. But I would have the food and supplies first, so that you can eat. And then, well, gold and silver on top of that is great. And I'm an advocate of that, but that's not, gold and silver are definitely not the highest priority.
Excellent, Michael. Well, I really appreciate you bringing all of these different things to our attention here. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
Yeah, I would encourage people, you know, because these are very troubled times and people are saying, what in the world's happening? What in the world's happening to our planet, to our world? Well, I come at things from a unique perspective. You know, I'm a Christian, and I believe that we are living in what the Bible describes as the end times. And so if people are interested in that, and they're interested in kind of a roadmap of what's ahead and what we're moving into. In fact, a lot of things I've written in my last two books have already happened, you know. But I've written a couple of books over the last couple of years. I'd encourage people, they're on Amazon.com, digital format and paperback format. But one is entitled 7-Year Apocalypse. This is my newest book that I just wrote. It's all about that. And then the previous book that I wrote is entitled Lost Prophecies of the Future of America. Both of these are on Amazon.com, but they're going to give you a roadmap for what's ahead. They're going to give you a roadmap in terms of what we're moving into. And like I said, a bunch of the things I already wrote in my book have already happened. So if people are interested in end times, Bible prophecy, Book of Revelation, all the things that the Bible says about what's going to happen in the last days and how the piece of the puzzle are literally coming together. For example, Lost Prophecies of the Future of America, Chapter 9, World War III, I talk about United States conflict with Russia, and it's happening, you know. It's happening now. I wrote this book a couple of years ago, but basically I'm very serious. When I say it's a roadmap, these books are a roadmap, I'm very serious. So if people want to learn more, these are available on Amazon.com in Kindle and in paperback format.
And of course, your blog that kind of keeps everyone abreast of what's happening throughout the world is available at theeconomiccollapseblog.com as well.
Yeah, or they can just go to Google. If you type in the economic collapse, it's the first result that comes up.
Excellent. Michael, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.